Now, it is axiomatic that education is one of the areas reserved to the states under the 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution. The court has recognized this, saying that the right and the power of the state to regulate the method of providing for the education of its youth at public expense is clear. And the education of the people in schools maintained by state taxation is a matter belonging to the respective states. And any interference on the part of the federal authority with the management of such schools cannot be justified except in the case of a clear and unmistakable disregard of rights secured by the supreme law of the land. Hence, as one of the district courts put it, it is not the function of the federal court to make educational policy or to resolve conflicts in educational theory. Neither is it the function of the court to substitute its judgment for that of the state and local school authorities. All the court can and should do is determine whether federally protected rights were violated. Now, whether one may agree with the activists as to the preferred freedoms, that is, the privileges and immunities that have been taken over from earlier articles of the Federal Bill of Rights and brought within the 14th Amendment by a process of absorption, as established in the famous footnote 4 of Mr. Justice Stone, it is a fact, nevertheless, that there has been a tremendous increase in cases relating to civil rights and liberties reaching the court for decision. The Commission on Law and Social Action of the American Jewish Congress reports that while of the 160 opinions of the 1935-36 term of the court, only two related to this subject. Of the 120 opinions handed down by the court at its 1960-61 term, a total of 54 related thereto. It is thus not surprising that most of the decisions of the court directly affecting public education in the states have been in that area. Now, these rights lie at the very heart of our way of life, and it becomes ever more apparent as our increasingly complex society moves along the thorny paths of our modern times that judicial decisions and Supreme Court opinions are among the greatest educational forces in America. In passing judgment on living issues, in resolving complexities which are at any given moment puzzling and dividing us, it teaches the demanding lesson of free government. As under the United States Constitution, education is a governmental function reserved to the states, so also does the Constitution of the State of New York ordain that education is the responsibility and a prerogative of the state, requiring the state legislature to provide for the maintenance and support of a system of free common schools wherein all the children of the state may be educated. It provides further that the governing body of the state educational system is the Board of Regents of the University of the State of New York, whose chief executive officer is the Commissioner of Education, who likewise is a constitutional officer. In addition to the vast administrative powers which the state legislature over the years has entrusted both to the Board of Regents and to the Commissioner, the latter also possesses judicial powers over the state school system. And his decisions are not subject to review by the Board of Regents, and, to quote the law, are final and conclusive and not subject to question or review in any place or court whatever. I might note here that the state courts, in spite of the unambiguous language that I've just read you, will review such decisions to a limited extent, that is, to ascertain if the decision is purely arbitrary, in the sense that no reasonable person could have reached such a decision on the record. While the policy-making functions of the regents and the administrative powers of the commissioner extend over the entire field of education, from nursery school to colleges and universities, and even into the licensure and practice of all the professions in New York State except the law, the judicial power of the commissioner is limited to the elementary and secondary level of the state's educational system. And there's an exception here, too, with respect to the City University of New York, which is also subject to such judicial review because the statute specifically says or designates the New York City higher education system as a part of the common school system of the state, or rather of the city, and therefore of the state. It is this judicial power which, perhaps more than anything else, has contributed to the unified growth of a true state system of education. It is through their judicial decisions that commissioners of education since 1812 have built a great body of common law applicable to the school districts of the state. It is that judicial power also which principally enables the commissioner to implement and enforce, in appropriate cases, new legal demands created by decisions of the High Court. In addition to administrative and judicial powers, both the Board of Regents and the commissioner are also possessed, subject to and in conformity to the Constitution and laws of the state, of legislative powers, which likewise are significant in the possible implementation of newly defined legal rights. Such legislative enactments consist of the rules of the regents and the regulations of the commissioner. As in nearly all other states, the operation and management of the public education has, under the principle of home rule, been placed in the hands of the local school districts. 100 years ago, there were 12,000 school districts in the state of New York. But that number has been greatly reduced through a continuous process of school district reorganization, especially since 1925, when substantial state aid incentives were established for that purpose. So at the present time, we have only 997 school districts, of which 800 operate schools. It is significant, I think, to mention also that school district boundaries and municipal boundaries, with few exceptions, do not coincide in New York. Even though at the inception of our school district system in 1812, the school district was a subdivision of the town, the continuous process of boundary alterations and consolidations and larger types of reorganizations has resulted in ever greater school districts. More than half of our school districts now in extending beyond county lines. Significant also is the fact that except in four of our large cities and six of our smaller city school districts, school boards are elected by the qualified voters of the district rather than being appointed by municipal or other authorities. The voting qualifications, too, are different from those used at the general election, as is the date of the annual school meeting and election. The result is as complete a divorce as is possible between the school system and party politics. The exception here is the so-called Big Six city school districts, which operate in fiscal dependence on city authorities. And this, of course, creates various problems relating to the school systems of these cities, since no single agency can be held fully responsible for the operation of their schools. While the Board of Education has custody and control of the facilities and determines the program, hires the staffs, and is responsible for conduct of the system, it lacks fiscal control and hence fiscal responsibility. And this often makes the local implementation of state policies difficult. In reviewing the structure and resources of the state in the area of education, I might say just a brief word about the finances. The operation of our school districts are supported principally from two sources: the local real estate tax and the apportionment of state aid. The state shares with the locality in expenses of general operations, building construction, and transportation. State aid is apportioned on an equalization basis, with more aid to the poor districts and with a minimum local tax effort required of all districts. In addition, of course, increasingly larger amounts of federal aid are now being made available for various purposes. As far as the disposition of financial resources of a district is concerned, the legislative power of appropriation, except in the city school districts, rests basically with the voters assembled at the annual school meetings. The local Board of Education does retain sole control over teacher salaries beyond the state established minimum and over a group of items known as ordinary contingent expenses, which consist of the minimum running expenses necessary to keep the schools open in accordance with the constitutional mandate. So this then is the framework within which the legislative, the judicial, and administrative powers of the State Board of Regents and the Commissioner must be exercised whenever a decision of the United States Supreme Court requires the use of these powers in relation to the schools of New York State. It is always possible, of course, to request the legislature to enact other measures, additional powers, or particularly additional funds for such purposes as may be indicated. But the legislative process has its obvious limitations, both from the standpoint of the time element and from its inherent uncertainties. Finally, mention must it must of course be made of our state courts and their relationship to the school system. There are two areas in which they can and do become instrumental in educational litigation and in implementing decisions of the United States Supreme Court. First, they may be called upon directly by a litigant who may wish to seek redress through the courts rather than coming to the Commissioner of Education. In all cases, excepting those involving school district meeting or election matters and proceedings for the removal from office of a school district officer, the aggrieved party has a choice of tribunals. The second possibility of such interaction is the review of the commissioner's judicial decisions by the state courts. An example of the former category is the Attabo case, which dealt with an attack on the New York City school district pairing method of reducing racial imbalance. Here the courts upheld the school district and the United States Supreme Court refused review. An example of the other category would be the Viteri and Hummel cases, where the commissioner's decision requiring the Malvern School Board to change attendance zones was reviewed in the state courts, and while reversed in the Supreme Court, which in New York, as you know, is the lowest court, was upheld by the appellate division of the Supreme Court and by the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals. And again, certiorari was denied by the High Court. Well, now, having briefly highlighted the court in its general pertinent setting and having set forth the legal and structural resources of the state of New York to deal with problems posed by court decisions in our area of concern, I shall now speak of some of the specific problems on which the court has ruled. By way of preference in this connection, reference must be made to a decision of the court which did not deal directly with New York State, but nevertheless has affected our system considerably, as of course it has influenced all others, other states in the nation, and I refer to the famous Pierce cases. The part of the opinion in the Pierce litigation which is most generally referred to today deals with a paramount right of the parents to determine the kind of education they wish their children to have. The court, of course, conceded the right of the state to insist on certain minimum requirements which had to be met by such non-public schools. Certain amendments to the New York State compulsory education law enacted shortly after this decision, and most likely the result thereof, include provisions requiring that instruction in non-public schools be at least substantially equivalent in amount and quality to that provided in the public schools of the district of residence. The reason for the present reference is, of course, the fact that the dichotomy between public and non-public schools vitally affects the public school system in various respects. Among the areas in which the decisions of the United States Supreme Court have directly affected public education in New York State, I shall refer to four: church and state, review of action of local school boards and school meetings, review of actions relating to higher and professional education, and finally, de facto segregation. Pending before the United States Supreme Court is the case of Stein versus Oshinsky, in which the Board of Regents of the State of New York is one of the defendants. This matter is properly referred to as the Cookie Prayer case. Certain kindergarten classes in one of the schools in Brooklyn had been saying simple little children's prayers in connection with their cookies and milk, both morning and afternoon. This practice was discontinued on order of the school principal after questions had been raised by certain parents as to the legality in view of the rulings of the court in Engle versus Vitale and in the Shemp and Murray cases. Thereafter, parents who wished the practice continued brought suit in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of New York, alleging that the school had a constitutional duty to allow children to say voluntary prayers in the classroom. The district court held with the plaintiffs, but was reversed by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. A petition for certiorari is presently pending before the United States Supreme Court. Defendants relied on the holding of the court in Engle that the mere fact that a prayer is voluntary cannot serve to free it from the limitations of the Establishment Clause. Another feature of the case is also perhaps noteworthy. Plaintiffs relied on their contention that these prayers were sought by the parents and are entirely voluntary, and that therefore Engle and Shemp were not applicable. At the same time, however, the record indicated that the kindergarten children here involved came from 7 different denominations, and it seemed obvious to all defendants that the saying aloud and in unison of any prayer at all was completely impossible without actual initiation, guidance, and direction of the teacher, so that the attempt of plaintiffs to distinguish this procedure from the ones declared impermissible by the court was necessarily without substance. The fact that the procedure used was no different than that used in Engle and Schimpf is buttressed further by the finding of the district judge that regulations of the school authorities were necessary to the procedure, thus requiring government to abandon its stance of neutrality. And this last aspect of the district court decision was, of course, the reason why an appeal from that court became necessary. If indeed the Supreme Court were to agree with the position of the district court, defendants would need guidance in view of its prior holdings as to the measure and limits of such regulations to be enacted both by the state and local school boards. In connection with this subject, it is also proper to refer briefly to the fact that the decision of the court in Engle was the direct result of action by the New York State Board of Regents. That board in 1951 had specifically recommended to the school districts of the state, in connection with the Pledge of Allegiance, of a prayer which had been carefully culled from various basic documents of our national heritage. While the action was brought against the local school board, which had followed the recommendation, the regents appeared amicus curiae in support of the local district. It may be interesting to note that the decision of the court was to the same effect, and in fact used some phraseology almost identical with that of a judicial decision of the superintendent of common schools, who was the predecessor of the Commissioner of Education, back in 1839. Noteworthy here also is another line of cases that involved the New York State education system and twice reached the court. And there's local color is added by the fact that the petitioner in some of these cases is a close relative of Vashta McCollum, whose release time suit was directed against your fair city. Her father-in-law, Joseph Lewis, representing the United States Freethinker Society, many years ago objected to the New York City release time program, which, unlike the Champaign counterpart, was and is conducted outside the public school buildings. The case did not at that time reach the United States Supreme Court, but after the McCollum decision, and presumably sparked by certain dicta in that case, another proceeding was brought which culminated in the court's upholding the New York State release time program. More recently, Mr. Lewis turned his attention to the insertion of the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. Congress in 1954, as you recall, amended the wording of the pledge set forth in the United States Code to add these words as used in the Gettysburg Address. Shortly thereafter, the Board of Regents added the same words to the regulations of the Commissioner of Education, which recommends the wording of the United States Code for use whenever desired by the local school boards. 2 years later, the pamphlet distributed by my state education department relating to the use of the flag in the schools was revised, and Mr. Lewis, upon finding the changed wording, instituted suit in state courts. So my legal aides found themselves in the unique position of defending not only myself and the Board of Regents, but also President Lincoln and the Congress of the United States. The state courts upheld the use of the amended pledge in the public schools, and the U.S. Supreme Court refused certiorari. Involved in this matter was, of course, the fact that the court had ruled in Barnett that no pupil could be compelled, against his or her conscience, to participate in the flag salute. Then consequently, a pupil with conscientious objection to the saying of the amended version of the pledge likewise could not be so compelled. The Barnett case, incidentally, raises some very perplexing and interesting questions. A literal reading of the various opinions reveals constant reference to the word conscience. A careful analysis of the opinions, however, shows that the word is used clearly, at least by 5 of the justices, as referring to the relation of man in his own mind to the Creator, to his Creator, the higher power, the tremendium, or whatever concept an individual may choose to use. The facts of the case, which of course cannot be ignored, deal purely with a matter of religion, And yet the majority opinion, particularly, is so broad in its phraseology as to seem to equate the word conscience and the word opinion. To read Barnett in this way would effectively eliminate the police power, both state and federal, in its entirety. This question arises in a variety of ways in the school system. There is, for instance, the case of the New York City school teacher who refused to participate in civil defense drills because he claimed a conflict with his conscience. Discharged by the Board of Education, he brought suit in the state court. The court dismissed the case, saying that while he had the right to live according to his conscience, he did not have a constitutional right to be a teacher. State law requires civil defense drills to be conducted in the schools. While this decision follows the famous opinion of Mr. Justice Holmes in the McAuliffe case when he was a member of the Massachusetts bench, it seems to me that the conflict here is much deeper. The real question is the extent to which the plain opinion, when expressed in action, of the individual about the wisdom or desirability of governmental decrees, either executive or legislative, is protected by the Bill of Rights. A similar question arises when a student refuses to render the flag salute and to pledge allegiance on the basis other than religion. When, for instance, a student refuses to do so because he is opposed to nationalism and believes in world government, is this a matter of opinion or of conscience? And as a matter of law, can he be compelled to participate on pain of expulsion? Such questions will most likely need to be decided by the court sooner or later. Well, as indicated initially, the judicial power of the New York State Commissioner of Education is an excellent tool for the implementation of high court decisions. And the cases of Engle and Shemp provide an apt illustration. When immediately following these two decisions of the court, certain action was taken by two Long Island school districts contrary to the same. Appeals were instituted by certain members of the communities, asking for orders directing the respective boards to follow the mandates of the court. In both cases, such orders were duly made in proceedings before the commissioner, and the matter settled without the necessity of further court action. And I have included in my paper a number of other New York State cases involving action either by the local school board or at school district meeting or election matters, which have reached the high court. But I'm not going to take your time this afternoon to read all of these. Most of them deal with relatively minor local matters, such as the denial of the use of school buildings to certain organizations, wrangles over voting procedures, bond issues, and as I indicated, as of now, the power of a school authorities to prescribe dress in the schools. They are significant here only because of the sum total effect of the court's decisions in shaping the administration and practice of public education in a state. But because of their more general interest, I should like to mention briefly the communist cases. The New York State Legislature in 1949 enacted the so-called Feinberg Law, which required the Board of Regents to take action to eradicate subversive influences in the state school system. The Regents adopted rules to that effect, and similar provisions were also added to the state's civil service law. The New York City Board of Education, in consequence thereof, required all teachers to take an oath to the effect that he or she was not, and never had been, a member of the Communist Party. One Adler instituted suit in the state courts to have these statutes and rules declared unconstitutional. While he succeeded in the lower court, the higher courts reversed and the United States Supreme Court affirmed. In reaffirming its holding in Garner, the court said, "A teacher works in a sensitive area in a schoolroom. There he shapes the attitude of young minds toward the society in which they live. In this, the state has a vital concern. It must preserve the integrity of the schools." There was, however, on this issue, a great deal of litigation at the state level which never reached the high court. One difficult decision, which fell to my lot to make, related to a New York City teacher's refusal to testify as to whether he had ever been a member of the Communist Party, and he refused because he claimed that the next question, would require that he identify his fellow cell members. And he was ordered by the board to answer on pain of dismissal. Before me, then, was the question of whether a teacher's refusal to inform by naming his associates could be the basis for dismissal. My decision, for which I was roundly criticized in certain quarters, was that a teacher could not be dismissed for such refusal, since he bore no supervisory responsibility for the evaluation of other teachers. At the same time, however, a principal who does have such responsibility was held to be duty-bound to answer such a question concerning those for whom he is so responsible. The decision was attacked in the state courts and sustained throughout. And I might remind you at this point that the New York State Board of Regents was the first public body in the nation to try the Communist Party of the state of New York and the Communist Party of the United States, a trial made necessary by the Feinberg Law. And after several weeks of trial, they were found to be subversive in that they advocated the overthrow of the United States government by force, violence, or other unlawful means. And the party started a court review of their findings, but later abandoned the proceedings. I've also included in my paper a few cases relating to higher education and professional licensure, which I shall also omit from reading for the sake of time. Probably, also I might say I've left out, because they're no longer really applicable, a series of cases on movie licensure. As you know, one of the functions of the New York State Board of Regents and of my office for many years up until recently was the licensing of every motion picture that was shown in the theaters of New York State. And we've had some interesting times over those, and I'm sure you're familiar with some of those cases, but I won't get into that this afternoon. Probably the most vexing, I might say, thank goodness we have that no longer, probably the most vexing and difficult problem confronting education in the United States today is the problem of race relationships in the schools. Solutions for this problem, which strikes at the very root of our concepts of justice and democratic principles of equality of opportunity, will require the utmost ingenuity, statesmanship, understanding, and patience and firmness of everyone concerned with education. While housing and employment and other sociological and economic factors are involved, the educational aspects of the matter are nevertheless the heart of any possible solutions. Despite the enormous difficulties, our goal must be the elimination of segregated schools, whether de jure or de facto, and the achievement of a truly integrated educational system. Our stated aim is to educate our youth in preparation for full and articulate citizenship. And in our vast and widely diversified society, this cannot be achieved unless our youth of all races grow up with a first-hand knowledge and understanding of each other. Realism as well as idealism require that we recognize in our educational endeavor that citizenship in our country means membership in a society where every 10th person is a Negro and where the population in many sections includes large percentages of other races as well. Upon entering commerce or industry and the professions or any other field of human endeavor, our young citizens will have to come to terms with this composition of our body politic. Another facet of the problem is, of course, the fact that our youth must be taught the meaning of citizenship in terms of our Constitution, which does include the 14th Amendment. When the voting rights of a single citizen of the United States are in danger, so likewise are the voting rights of every last one of us. When the civil rights of any group of our fellow citizens are threatened, so are the civil rights of all of us. And finally, there is the fact that our world is steadily shrinking, and as we are telling the world about the virtues of American democracy, we had better practice at home, in our glass house, that which we are preaching. And this may all too soon become a matter of survival. The history of the problem of integrating the American Negro into the mainstream of American life goes back, of course, to the 14th Amendment. The early history of the court's reaction to this problem is unfortunately most inglorious, as the slaughterhouse cases and the early civil rights cases clearly show. In the former, the court denied the application of the Equal Protection clause to the Louisiana butchering monopoly, while the latter decision meant in practice the continuation of discrimination under the tolerant eyes of the states. Mr. Justice Harlan dissented even then, treating the right to equal accommodations at inns, theaters, and transportation facilities as legal rights rather than as social ones. Although an early decision of the court required desegregation of steamboats and other common carriers on the ground that interstate commerce required a uniform rule, the theory of separate but equal soon became the law of the land through the decision of Plessy versus Ferguson, with Mr. Justice Harlan again dissenting. It was not until the late 1930s that the court began to give serious consideration to the requirement of equality, beginning with the Keynes cases, the continuing through Mitchell, Scipio, McLaurin cases, and Sweat versus Painter. The court gradually worked its way toward facing the problem squarely, which it finally did in Brown, by unanimously reversing Plessy, thus vindicating Mr. Justice Harlan's dissent. And there followed a flood of litigation in the lower federal courts. But let me at this point return to the state of New York. Chapter 143 of the laws of 1850 gave the Brooklyn City Board of Education the power to organize and establish schools for Negro children. On a statewide basis, the same type of authorization for all school districts was contained in the laws of 1894 in New York. A man by the name of King brought suit in 1883 against the Board of Education for maintenance of a separate school of this type, but the Court of Appeals upheld the board, basing its decision on the holding of the United States Supreme Court in the Slaughterhouse cases. Another suit in 1899 was brought by one Cisco for the same purpose, but with the same effect, the court referring back to its earlier decision. It was not until 1938 that the legislature of the state of New York completely wiped out the effect of the 1894 law. And between 1938 and the late 1950s, commissioners of education in New York State dealt with a series of appeals in this area, generally dealing with charges of gerrymandering of school districts, which were usually decided by directing the school boards to restudy and realign zones. In January of 1960, the Board of Regents adopted its well-known policy statement, in which it referred to the decision of the High Court in Brown and said in part, "The state of New York has long held the principle that equal education opportunity for all children, without regard to differences in economic, national, religious, or racial background, is a manifestation of the vitality of our American democratic society and is essential to its continuation. Modern psychological knowledge indicates that schools enrolling students largely of homogeneous ethnic origin may damage the personality of minority group children. Such schools decrease their motivation and thus impair the ability to learn. Public education in such a setting is socially unrealistic, blocks the attainment of the goals of democratic education, and is wasteful of manpower and talent, whether the situation occurs by law or by fact." Now, since the application of these principles, however, continues to meet with a great deal of dissent and opposition, it becomes of the greatest importance to follow the decisions of our courts, both state and federal, so as to understand how fast and how far we may safely go. The courts themselves have not been having an easy time of it, as the integration of the American Negro into the mainstream of our life amounts to a constitutional renaissance and to a revolution of the first magnitude. So also has it been said that the American jurisprudence has been confronted with few challenges of comparable magnitude and difficulty. While Brown, of course, dealt with de jure segregation, the rationale of the decision is perhaps best expressed in the following passage. "Segregation of white and colored children in public schools has a detrimental effect upon the colored children. The impact is greater when it has the sanction of the law. For the policy of separating the races is usually interpreted as denoting the inferiority of the Negro group. A sense of inferiority affects the motivation of a child to learn. While the facts of the case related only to de jure resegregation, the portion that I've read here of the decision clearly shows that the rationale includes de facto segregation as well. And it is obvious that the effect on the growing mind of a Negro child is the same in either case. Nonetheless, it is a fact that the United States Supreme Court has not yet directly ruled on the question of de facto segregation, although it has had at least five opportunities to do so. And I would presume that the reason for the court's inaction is the extreme difficulty, if not impossibility, at this moment of formulating any kind of workable general rule that will fit all situations. Although some partial answers have emerged, there remains the problem of what to do in areas where the concentration of Negroes is so heavy that any solution that would fit smaller and more homogeneous communities is simply impractical. The decisions handed down by the courts up to this point, however, do provide some assistance in establishing guidelines for the administrative action which can and must be taken to meet this greatest challenge of our day in education. There is the Branch case. In this case, the United States District Court of the Eastern District of New York found that the central constitutional fact is the inadequacy of segregated education, that the public schools must deal with the inadequacy arising from adventitious segregation and cannot accept and endure it, segregation on the ground that it is not coerced or planned but accepted. And the court further stated in this case, failure to deal with a condition as really inflicts it, as does any grosser imposition of it. How far that duty extends is not answerable, perhaps in terms of an unqualified obligation to integrate public education without regard to circumstances, and it is certainly primarily the responsibility of the education authorities and not the courts to form the education system. Then there was the Blocker case. And here, the chief judge of the same United States District Court, after a long trial and a 60-page decision, ordered the integration of the Manhasset New York School District, retaining jurisdiction until full compliance. And it was purely a matter of de facto segregation arising from residential patterns in the growth of the district. In another case, the Balaban case, this case went through the state courts and involved action by the New York City School District Board of Education in the creation of the attendance zone for a new school. While the lower court reversed, the higher courts upheld the board, stating that the mere fact that correction of racial imbalance was a part of the purpose of the action did not make the same illegal or unconstitutional, and the high court denied certiorari. And then the Adebo case. This case involved a school pairing plan of the same district, that is the city of New York, which was upheld throughout by the state courts with certiorari denied also. The lower court, in a very well-written decision, pointed out that in addition to the intended result of correction of racial imbalance, the plan of the board resulted in a vast improvement of the entire program of the schools involved. And then there was, of course, one of the best-known cases, the Bell versus the school city, district of Gary, Indiana. While this case arose from Indiana, it must be mentioned here because in most, if not all, of the cases in New York State that I've referred to, the Bell case was cited in support of the opposition to any action promoting integration. It was there held by the federal courts that there does not exist under the United States Constitution a duty on the part of a local board to take affirmative steps to correct de facto segregation arising not from positive action of the board, but from residential patterns. As the New York State Court of Appeals pointed out, however, the question of the power of state educational authorities to take action on a voluntary basis for the correction of such racial imbalance was not involved in this case, that is the Bell case, and consequently the case has no bearing on the point. And again, the High Court denied certiorari. Now in the Malvern case, which is the case of Mitchell versus the Board of Education of Malvern, This case is probably the most troublesome one that I, as State Commissioner of Education, have had to deal with in this field, largely because of the extremely, and I can underline that word, extremely strong resistance of the community to what seems a relatively simple solution to the problem involved. Back in 1962, this geographically small, only 2 square miles, Long Island School District had integrated all grades except kindergarten through five. For these grades, there were 3 school buildings in the district, one of which had approximately 75% Negro enrollment, while the other two had approximately 14%. In 1963, several parents of Negro pupils in the predominantly Negro school appealed to the commissioner, protesting the failure of the Board of Education to equalize educational opportunities by maintaining the de facto segregated situation. Following oral argument in the case, the commissioner's advisory committee on human relations and community detentions, a 3-man group of knowledgeable and experienced individuals in matters of this kind, that I had set up to advise me in these cases, was asked to conduct a special study of the situation in Malvern and to recommend the most effective, feasible plan for eliminating the issue of racial imbalance. Based on their findings and recommendations, and after a further oral argument, a decision was rendered, ordering the district to reorganize the pupil attendance areas so that all pupils from kindergarten to grade 3 inclusive would attend one or the other of the 2 schools having the lowest proportion of Negroes, and all pupils in grades 4 and 5 would attend the school with the largest proportion of Negroes. This meant the substitution of a single attendance area for grades 4 and 5, that is, the entire district would be the attendance area, and the substitution of 2 attendance zones for 3 in grades kindergarten through 3, and following the so-called Princeton plan. The Malvern Board twice petitioned the commissioner for reopening of that decision, which was denied, whereupon certain white parents brought suit in the state courts to have the decision annulled. While the lower courts reversed, the lower court reversed, based on a state civil rights provision, the appellate division sustained the commissioner's decision, stating that a civil rights provision could hardly be used for a purpose diametrically opposed to its intent. The State Court of Appeal affirmed 5-2, and the United States Supreme Court denied certiorari. By that time, 2 years had passed, and the so-called Negro school had progressed from 75% to over 90% Negro enrollment, leading to a further deterioration of the situation. At the conclusion of the long legal battles, the date for the implementation of the original order was set for January 31st, 1966. That was the beginning of the second semester. I might say I was on a trip around the world when I just left New York and was in Stockholm when, thinking that I had gotten away from New York State problems, when I happened to see a New York European edition of the New York Times with my picture on it and the decision of the United States Supreme Court, so I found I couldn't get away even at that distance. Several weeks before that date of January the 31st, another suit was instituted in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of New York, seeking to overturn the commissioner's 1963 action or decision based on the same constitutional argument, but augmented this time by the Civil Rights Act of 1965. And the district court on February the 14th dismissed that action on the merits. In the meantime, I had postponed the date for the implementation of the order in Malvern to the date of the decision of the district court in order to avoid the possibility of having to move the children twice. From that order of postponement, the original appellants brought action in the Albany County Supreme Court, which was decided just 2 weeks ago in their favor, although by that time the matter had become academic because the original case had been decided in my favor. Well, opposition to the integration plan in Malvern continues, although the Board of Education is now proceeding to implement the order. And despite opposition and all the difficulties, there are signs of more general adjustment and acceptance, and I'm confident that things will work out in that beleaguered community, and that Malvern will be a stronger community as a result. One or two other cases in this area. This is the Offerman case. This was an action brought in the United States District Court. I might say the Malvern case, that one of the big issues here in the state courts was whether the Commissioner of Education had the authority, the power, to order a school district to develop a particular plan of eliminating racial imbalance. And this was the thing that was upheld throughout the courts. It was not, and they were not getting into the merits of the plan. They were simply saying that the commissioner did have the power to do what he did there. In the Offerman case, this was an action brought in the United States District Court for the Western District of New York, challenging the commissioner's power to make an order directed to the Board of Education of the Buffalo School District, requiring them to produce a plan to correct racial imbalance, and in an appeal brought by certain parents from that district, and the court dismissed the action. Another case, Etter case in Rochester, involves the same approach. The school district of the city of Rochester agreed that an outlying suburban district, they agreed with an outlying suburban district to send 24 or 25 Negro students to the outlying district under contract. This would relieve racial imbalance in Rochester and would give the almost all-white student population of the suburban district a measure of reverse integration. And a man named Etter brought suit in the state Supreme Court to declare that arrangement unconstitutional, and the court refused. At the same time, Etter and another person appealed to the commissioner from the action of the outside Board of Education in making that agreement without referring the matter to the voters of the suburban district. This appeal was dismissed because state law clearly authorizes such action. Well, now, in examining these cases and these decisions, it is obvious that the court has been of great practical help in establishing guidelines for action by educational authorities to eliminate segregation. And it is equally obvious that further decisions of the court will be required to provide a framework of action broad enough to encompass all aspects of the problem. And it is also obvious, however, that the ultimate solution of this matter rests upon public desire and will. The court can interpret the law and declare that a particular law or practice violates the Constitution, but it cannot make law. This is left to the Congress and to the state legislatures. Where, for example, the laws of a state provide that schools cannot be built without a vote of the people of the district in question, the court cannot force the voters to vote in favor of a new school for the sole purpose of correcting racial imbalance. Nor can the court force the state legislature to change the state law so as to take the right of decision away from the voters. These things must be and should be left to the political processes. Although the court can exert a measure of control over government bodies and officials, it cannot control the minds of men. Solutions for the problems involved in the elimination of segregation and the achievement of true integration will require not only legal action, but even more significantly, the will and the effort of all segments of our nation to live by the rules to which we have for so long paid lip service. Now, these examples, of which I have mentioned only a few, of interaction between the courts and public education, although dealing primarily with New York State issues, serve to demonstrate the general truth of Mason's statement that I quoted earlier, that judicial decisions and Supreme Court opinions are among the greatest educational forces in America. In no area of society has the impact of our attempts to learn the demanding lesson of free government been greater than in education. Our principle of equality of education opportunity is so interwoven with all other rights that education has come to be considered an integral part of the foundation upon which these rights rest. Therefore, in the past two decades, when so many trends and conditions have operated to bring about an ever-growing concern and a concentration on matters of social justice, education has been undergoing a time of severe test and trial. Few persons not directly involved in the administration of public education can fully appreciate the pressures, the stresses, the strains, the almost traumatic effect of recent intensive efforts to correct those conditions which limit equality of educational opportunity. In these efforts, the decisions of the Supreme Court have been a source of stability and strength. The kinds of issues with which education has had to deal recently are those which have involved radical departure from traditions and customs, thus inevitably arousing deep emotions, strong conflicting opinions, and creating explosive community tensions. To have the force necessary to overcome the difficulties and obstacles arising from such an atmosphere, educational decisions on these issues need to have a clear and unmistakable foundation in law. The decisions of the High Court, with their definitive finality, bring with them the assurance of legal justification which gives to the educator the confidence on which to build programs and procedures legally as well as educationally sound. In the main, the decisions of the court have tended to reaffirm and strengthen the authority of the states in dealing with the problems of public education. In this turbulent era of great demands upon public education, the power of the states has in too many instances, however, been found to be more theoretical than actual. And many states, even where there has been a strong will to proceed, have experienced great difficulty in carrying out the kinds of action for educational progress which court decisions have validated. Attempts to proceed have pointed up weaknesses, such as archaic legal structure, outmoded policies and practices, inadequate financial provisions, political entanglements, and other restrictive factors in our educational system. The hampering effect of these weaknesses have been particularly apparent in efforts to carry out the court's decisions with respect to the elimination of segregated schools. Even in New York State, where in matters of education the power of the state is relatively strong, and where there has been the strong support of court decisions affirming the state's clear authority to correct racial imbalance, tremendous difficulties have been and are being encountered. Our experience in dealing with de facto segregation has demonstrated emphatically that stronger state action is necessary. There is not yet sufficient momentum to bring about action unprodded in many local situations. Financial incentives may have to be provided. Many communities are unable or unwilling to provide the extra funds needed to implement effective integration plans. They feel the problem is not of their making and that they should not be saddled with the extra costs often involved in correcting it. Other communities are held back because existing laws make difficult, if not virtually impossible, the adjustment of school district boundary lines, the consolidation of districts, or cooperative arrangements with other districts in order to reduce or eliminate racial imbalance. The Board of Regents in New York this year is requesting legislation to strengthen our efforts to promote and encourage the elimination of imbalance. But at the same time, several bills have been introduced at the current session of the legislature to amend the education law by adding certain restrictive provisions which would inhibit the use of the power of the state, as well as that of the local authorities, in taking appropriate actions to deal with the problem and seriously retard the efforts to achieve equality of educational opportunity. There are bills in the legislature, for example, that would say that no child may be removed from his neighborhood school without the consent of his parents. And this sounds very innocuous, and most people reading it think, why shouldn't there be such legislation? And yet is it just this kind of legislation that will tie the hands of the local authorities and of the state authorities in trying to deal with this thorny question? The Committee on Civil Rights of the New York State Bar Association has called for the defeat of these bills, asserting that these measures are of doubtful constitutionality in that by thus inhibiting any remedial action by school authorities, the measures may themselves constitute forbidden state action in the furtherance of racial separation. The obvious conclusion to be drawn from the experiences in New York State and those reported from other states in dealing with de facto segregation is that the means presently available to state educational authorities are not adequate for achieving the goals implicit in the court's decision in this field. The weaknesses which have produced this inadequacy exist in varying type and degree among the states. With a diversity of 50 state education systems, there are, of course, wide variations in ability, resources, and in structure, and in the effectiveness of the exercise of state responsibility for education. But whatever the weaknesses may be that exist within a particular state, they impose upon the executive and legislative leaders of that state the obligation to support corrective action so that the educational authorities will be able to exercise fully their power. And since education is a state function, it is vital that state educational authorities have every provision necessary to enable them to provide the leadership which is their proper role. The state must have the authority and the means to be a moving force in education, to initiate, to implement, to take corrective action, to encourage imaginative and innovative approaches. The broad approach necessary for the solution of the massive and complex problems facing education today most properly and effectively comes from the state, which is close enough to the local level to assess local situations, and yet far enough removed to take into account the full scope of federal, state, local relationships under which education must function. The highlighting of the need for greater strength at the state level, which has occurred as a result of the efforts of the states to implement the court's decisions, has been one of the most significant consequences of the interaction between the court and public education. In helping to create a more general awareness of the fact that state power is a reality only where backed up by state strength, the court has rendered a valuable service to education. The court's decisions are helping to reinforce, through definition and clarification, the legal foundation upon which education can build, dealing as they properly must with education not in terms of making policy or resolving conflicts in educational theories, but in terms of protection against violation of federally protected rights. The court has provided important guidelines for state action, clearly pointing the way back to the source, the Constitution, and most particularly, the Bill of Rights. Finally, I find it apposite to quote the late Mr. Justice Jackson, a fellow New Yorker, when he said, "However well the court and its bar may discharge their tasks, the destiny of this court is inseparably linked to the fate of our democratic system of representative government. Judicial functions, as we have evolved them, can be discharged only in that kind of society which is willing to submit its conflicts to adjudication and to subordinate power to reason. The future of the court may depend more upon the competence of the executive and legislative branches of government to solve their problems adequately and in time than upon the merit which is its own." Thank you.